This is Audible.
You're listening to the audio production of Love Does by Bob Goff, published by Thomas Nelson and read by the author.
Introduction. Love Does. I used to think I needed an office to be a lawyer, but now I know all I need is an island. I do all of my best thinking on Tom Sawyer Island at Disneyland. There's a picnic table at the end of a little pier right across from the pirate ship. I suppose most people think this place is just a prop because there's a couple wooden kegs marked gunpowder and some pirate paraphernalia hung over the railings. But it's not a prop to me. It's my office. All the times I've gone, I've never seen anyone sitting at my table on my pier or any real pirates on the pirate ship. I guess that makes them my table and my pier and my pirate ship. Lawyers just decide stuff like that. While I'm willing to share my table and my pirate ship, truth be known, I only want to share it with people who can dream. We all want to have a place where we can dream and escape anything that wraps steel bands around our imagination and creativity. Tom Sawyer Island is a place where I conspire with people, where immense capers have been launched, and where whimsy runs wild. The return address of many of the stories you'll find in this book is, in fact, that pier on Tom Sawyer Island. What I like the most about Tom Sawyer Island is that it's mine. I'm a good sport about sharing it with other kids and visitors, but the whole thing is mine nonetheless. Something happens when you feel ownership. You no longer act like a spectator or a consumer because you're an owner. Faith is at its best when it's that way too. It's best lived when it's owned. I have a season pass to Disneyland, and I can take a train there anytime I want. If I want to take a friend, I have an old classic motorcycle with a sidecar, a Harley-Davidson Springer Softail. I keep it in the garage for special occasions. It's the kind of motorcycle you'd see in a picture under the title Whimsy in the encyclopedia. It's cool, it's blue, and it's loud. I like riding it because I'm fully engaged while getting from here to there. I also like that I can bring a friend along as well. When I pass by people, they smile because they've never seen a sidecar, but I can tell they were wishing they were a passenger. Whimsy is a lot that way. It needs to be fully experienced to be fully known. Whimsy doesn't care if you're the driver or the passenger. All that matters is that you're on your way. Here's a strange truth I've noticed. Almost everyone knows about Tom Sawyer Island at Disneyland, but most people don't go. Maybe it's because it's surrounded by water and you have to take a raft to get there. But it's really not that tough to do. Lots of people want to go. Some people even plan to go. But most forget or just don't get around to it. It's one of those, we'll get to that next trip kinds of places for a lot of people. Tom Sawyer Island is like most people's lives, I think. They never get around to crossing over to it. Living a life fully engaged and full of whimsy and the kind of things that love does is something most people plan to do, but along the way, they just kind of forget. Their dreams become one of those, we'll get to it next time deferrals. The sad thing is, though, for many people, there's no next time, because passing on the chance to cross over is an overall attitude towards life rather than a single decision. They need a change of attitude, not more opportunities. There are no admission requirements at Tom Sawyer Island. Doesn't matter how tall or short you are, old or young, religious or not. There are no lines at Tom Sawyer Island. It can be whatever you want it to be. You can do countless things there. Most of them involve running and jumping and using your creativity and imagination. It's a place where you can go and just do stuff. In that way, it's a place that mirrors life well, at least the opportunity to do much with our lives. From my office at Tom Sawyer Island, I have a fantastic perch to look around and see how a sea of people live. Tom Sawyer Island isn't a ride. It's not just about distraction or thrills, and it's not the kind of place you go to be entertained either. It has all the potential you bring to it. Nothing more, nothing less. To find out just how much that is, all you have to do is show up. You don't need a plan, you just need to be present. Somewhere in each of us, I believe there's a desire for a place like Tom Sawyer Island. A place where the stuff of imagination, whimsy and wonder are easy to live out. Not just think about or put off until next time. This is a weighty thing to think about on my island. But I often consider what I'm tempted to call the greatest lie of all time. And that lie can be bound up in two words. Someone else. On Tom Sawyer Island, I reflect on God, who didn't just choose someone else to express his creative presence to the world, who didn't tap the rock star or the popular kids to get things done. He chose you and me. We are the means, the method, the object, and the delivery vehicles. God can use anyone, for sure. If you can shred on a Fender or one best personality, you're not disqualified. It just doesn't make you more qualified. You see, God usually chooses ordinary people like us to get things done. As I sit on my island, it becomes clear that we need to stop plotting the course and instead just land the plane on our plans to make a difference by getting to the do part of faith. That's because love is never stationary. In the end, love doesn't just keep thinking about it or keep planning for it. Simply put, love does. Chapter 1. I'm with you. I used to want to fix people, but now I just want to be with them. When I was in high school, I met a guy named Randy. Randy had three things I didn't have: a Triumph motorcycle, a beard, and a girlfriend. It just didn't seem fair. I wanted all three in ascending order. I asked around and I found out Randy didn't even go to high school. He just hung out there. I had heard about guys like that and figured I should keep my distance, so I did. Later I heard that Randy was a Christian and worked for an outfit called Young Life. I didn't know much about any of that stuff, but it helped explain the beard and made it okay that he was hanging out at the high school, I guess. Randy never offered me a ride on his motorcycle, but he tried to engage me in discussions about Jesus. I kept him at arm's length, but that didn't seem to chill his interest in finding out who I was and what I was about. I figured maybe he didn't know anyone his age, so we eventually became friends. I was a lousy student, and I found out I could take a test to get a certificate that was equivalent to a high school diploma. I couldn't figure out how to sign up for the test, though, which on reflection was a pretty good indicator that I should stay in high school. My plan was to move to Yosemite and spend my days climbing the massive granite cliffs. At 6 foot 4 inches tall and 220 pounds, I didn't really have a rock climber's build. I wonder what made me think there was a rock climber in me. When you're in high school, you don't give much thought to what you can't do, though. For most people, that gets learned later, and for still fewer, gets unlearned for the rest of your life. At the beginning of my junior year, I decided it was time to leave high school and make the move to Yosemite. I had a down vest, two red bandanas, a pair of rock climbing shoes, $70, and a Volkswagen Bug. What else did I need? I'd find work in the valley and spend my off time climbing the mountains. More out of courtesy than anything, I swung by Randy's house first thing on a Sunday morning to say goodbye and let him know I was leaving. I knocked on the door, and after a long couple minutes, Randy answered. He was groggy and bedheaded. I'd obviously woken him. I gave him the rundown on what I was doing. All the while, Randy stood patiently in the doorway, trying his best to suppress a puzzled expression. "You're leaving soon?" he asked when I finished. "Yeah, right now, actually," I said as I straightened my back and barreled my chest to show I meant business. "Look, Randy, it's just time for me to get out of here. I just came by to thank you for hanging out with me and being such a great friend." Randy kept his earnest and concerned face, but he didn't say a word. "Oh, hey," I inserted. "Will you tell your girlfriend goodbye for me, too? You know, next time you see her?" Again, no words from Randy. He had this weird, faraway look on his face, like he was looking right through me. He snapped back into our conversation. "Hey, Bob, would you wait here for a second while I check something out?" "No sweat, Randy. I had nothing but time now. What did I care?" Randy disappeared for a few minutes into the house while I stood awkwardly on his porch with my hands in my pockets. When he came back to the door, he had a tattered backpack hanging over his shoulder by one frayed strap and a sleeping bag under his other arm. He was focused and direct. All he said was this: "Bob, I'm with you." Something in his words rang right through me. He didn't lecture me about how I was blowing it and throwing opportunities away by leaving high school. He didn't tell me I was a fool and that my idea would fall off the tracks on the way to the launch pad. He didn't tell me I would surely crater, even if I did briefly lift off. He was resolute, unequivocal, and had no agenda. He was just with me. Despite the kind gesture, it was pretty odd to think he wanted to come along. Sure, I guess," I said half-heartedly. "You sure?" "Yeah, Bob, I'm in. If you wouldn't mind, what if I caught a ride with you? Randy stood with a determined look. So let me get this straight. You want to drive to Yosemite with me right now? Yep, that's right. I can find my way back after we get there and you get settled in. I'm not sure why I accepted Randy's generous self-invitation. I guess it's because it caught me totally off guard. No one had ever expressed an interest in me like that before. Well, sure, I stammered, as we both stood awkwardly in a stoop. I guess we should get going then. And with that, Randy closed the door to his little house, and we walked side by side to my Volkswagen Bug. He plopped into the passenger seat and threw his stuff on top of mine on the back seat. We got to Yosemite before nightfall, and it occurred to me for the first time we had no place to stay. We had a couple sleeping bags, no tent, and very little money, so we snuck in through the back of a platform tent, set up for one of those paper night campsites. We slept towards the back so we could make our escape if an upstanding tent renter showed up in the night. Fortunately, no one came, and the next morning we woke up to a chilly but glorious morning in the Yosemite Valley. To the north of us, El Capitan soared 3,000 feet straight up like a huge granite soldier. Half Dome dominated the landscape to the east. These were my companions. This was my cathedral. I was in the valley-wide living room of my new home. Now it was time to get a job and settle in. I rolled over in my sleeping bag, thinking about how great it was to have Randy with me. I was a little nervous, but also excited about my newfound freedom. I was a man now. I felt my chin for any sign of whiskers. Nothing yet, but I shaved anyway, just in case. Randy and I dusted off the stiffness that comes from tent camping and went to Camp Curry Company cafeteria. I thought I would get a job flipping pancakes in the mornings, which would leave the rest of the day for climbing. I finished the job application in front of the manager, handed it to him, and he gave it right back, sternly shaking his head no. He didn't even pretend to be interested, but I was secretly thankful he at least humored me enough to let me apply. No matter. Undaunted, I went to one of the rock climbing outfitters with a storefront in the valley. I told them I'd do whatever they needed. I was sure that what I lacked in experience, I could make up for by what I lacked in maturity or raw intelligence. They said they didn't have any work for me either, and the jobs were tight and almost impossible to get in the valley. I walked out of the store discouraged and looked at Randy, who was leaning up against the Volkswagen. Rather than feeding my discouragement or saying, "I told you so," Randy fed my soul with words of truth and perspective. "Bob, you can do this thing if you want. You have the stuff it takes to pull it off. These guys don't know what they're missing. Let's try a few more places." And then, just like he had said the day before on the porch, Randy reiterated his statement. "Either way, Bob, I'm just with you." His words gave me tremendous comfort. I applied at nearly every business in the valley and struck out every time. There were simply no jobs available and no hope of one opening up soon. The evening approached as the sun sank low in the hills. It was one of those sunsets displaying the kind of vibrant colors that would have made a painter's canvas look overambitious. But I was still heartened. This sunset was real. I was in Yosemite. My friend was with me, and I still had a shot at my dream. Randy and I headed back to the campsite and snuck into the same tent we had commandeered the night before. I didn't sleep well or long as I sorted through my very short list of options. There was no work. I had no money. I was a high school dropout, Randy snored, and I had to go to the bathroom. That about covered my list of problems from least to greatest. The next morning came with a crispness that only fueled my anxiety. Randy stirred next to me in his sleeping bag, gave a couple phlegm-filled coughs, and said in a much too cheery voice, "Let's go climb some rocks." We headed to the foot of one of the monolith cliffs and bouldered for a couple hours, talking trash to each other about who was the better climber. By midday, we headed back to the valley to see if any businesses had miraculously decided to expand their operations overnight. It felt like the shop owners had quietly met somewhere when they learned I was arriving in the valley and were conspiring against me to dash my dreams. The same rocks I had come to climb were now beginning to look like barricades. I applied at the remaining small storefronts I hadn't applied to the day before. Do I even need to waste my breath to tell you what happened? Randy and I sat on the front bumper of my Volkswagen Bug and leaned back against its flimsy and slightly rusted hood that buckled slightly under our weight. The sun was getting low in the valley again, and the granite cliffs I'd hoped to count as neighbors were casting long, dark shadows on the ground, each of the deepening shadows pointing towards the road exiting the valley. I only had a few bucks left after buying gas, and Randy offered to spring for dinner. As we walked back out to the car after eating, I turned to Randy and said, "You know, Randy, you've been great coming with me and everything, but it looks like I'm striking out. I think what I'll do is head back and just finish up high school." After a short pause, Randy said again what had become a comfort to me throughout the trip. "Man, whatever you decide, just know that either way I'm with you, Bob." Randy had been with me, and I could tell that he was with me in spirit as much as with his presence. He was committed to me and he believed in me. I wasn't a project, I was his friend. I wondered if maybe all Christians operated this way. I didn't think so, because most of them I had met until that time were kind of wimpy and seemed to have more opinions about what or who they were against than what they were for. Without much more discussion, Randy and I exchanged a silent look and a nod which meant we were done. Without a word spoken, I hopped in the driver's seat of the car, Randy hopped in the passenger seat, and we followed the path cast by the long shadows that day before. I was going back. We didn't talk much as we left Yosemite Valley, or for much of the way home for that matter. A dream of mine had just checked into hospice, and Randy was sensitive enough to know I just needed some margin to think. We drove for 5 or 6 quiet hours. Every once in a while, Randy would check on me in his confident and upbeat voice. "Hey, how you doing, Bob?" We pulled down some familiar streets and into Randy's driveway. There was another car in the drive next to Randy's. It looked like his girlfriend's. She visited often. We walked up to the front door and he opened it. I walked in behind Randy, uninvited, but somehow I still felt welcome. On the floor, I noticed a stack of plates and some wrapping paper, a coffee maker, some glasses. On the couch, there was a microwave, half in a box. I didn't understand at first. Had Randy just had a birthday? Was it his girlfriend's? A microwave seemed like a weird way to celebrate someone's arrival into the world. I knew Randy wasn't moving because there wouldn't have been wrapping paper. Then, from around the corner, the other half of his couple bounded out and threw her arms around Randy. "Welcome home, honey." Then the nickel dropped. I felt both sick and choked up in an instant. I realized that these were wedding presents on the floor. Randy and his girlfriend had just gotten married. And when I knocked on Randy's door on that Sunday morning, Randy didn't see just a high school kid who had disrupted the beginning of his marriage. He saw a kid who was about to jump the tracks. Instead of spending the early days of his marriage with his bride, he spent it with me, sneaking into the back of a tent. Why? It was because Randy loved me. He saw the need and he did something about it. He didn't just say he was for me or with me, he was actually present with me. What I learned from Randy changed my view permanently about what it meant to have a friendship with Jesus. I learned that faith isn't about knowing all the right stuff or obeying a list of rules. It's something more costly because it involved being present and making a sacrifice. Perhaps that's why Jesus is sometimes called Emmanuel, God with us. I think that's what God had in mind for Jesus to be present, to just be with us. It's also what he had in mind for us when it comes to other people. The world can make you think that love can be picked up at a garage sale or enveloped in a Hallmark card. But the kind of love that God created and demonstrated is a costly one because it involves sacrifice and presence. It's a love that operates more like a sign language than being spoken outright. What I learned from Randy about the brand of love Jesus offers is that it's more about presence than undertaking a project. It's a brand of love that doesn't just think about good things or agree with them or just talk about them. What I learned from Randy reinforced the simple truth that continues to weave itself into the tapestry of every great story. Love does. Chapter 2. Sniper Fire. I used to think I had to act a certain way to follow God, but now I know God doesn't want us to be typical. I heard about Jesus for the first time when I was in high school from a guy named Doug, who I used to shoot BB guns with. We would go out in the woods by a reservoir and shoot at cans or old car fenders. Neither of us was a very good shot, and we rarely hit what we were aiming for, so we just called whatever we hit the target. There are a lot of people who still do that. Being in the woods and armed makes a 15-year-old feel like he has chest hair. The prospect of losing an eye also kept us coming back. It's not necessarily a guy thing. Well, actually, yes, it's a guy thing. One day, Doug's BB gun broke, and he got a pellet gun. I wanted to have a pellet gun, too, but I couldn't find someone to hook me up with one, so I kept using my old BB gun I got when I was 8 years old. There was a big difference between Doug's legit pellet gun and my crummy BB gun. My gun didn't shoot very far or very well. After it was cocked once, it could almost shoot across the room. That is, unless the fan was on, then only half that distance. It did have a slot where you could put a couple drops of oil that would turn into a little puff of blue smoke when you pulled the trigger. Despite this fun little feature, mine was no match for Doug's gun, and we both knew it. Doug's pellet gun shot like a real gun, too. He could pump it up what seemed like an unlimited number of times, and we imagine it could pierce steel. He put a huge scope on the barrel and then put camouflage on the gun, mostly made of old socks painted green and some weeds. It was an awesome piece of firepower compared to my Daisy BB gun, even though mine had blue smoke and his didn't. I thought I'd save up for a pellet gun like Doug's and maybe a rifle rack too. Yes, definitely a rifle rack. One lazy afternoon, Doug and I were walking side by side along a trail in the woods. I was looking for new cans to shoot or to finish off ones we'd only wounded the week before. Suddenly, I noticed Doug wasn't at my side anymore. I looked to the left and to the right, but Doug was nowhere to be found. When I looked behind me, however, I saw the muzzle of Doug's pellet gun pointing at me from behind a tree, half a green sock hanging from the scope, which was up to his eye. I had become the next tin can, and I did what every hardened gunslinger would do. I ran. As I ran, I cocked my Daisy BB gun with the blue smoke, and just over the rise in the hill, I turned to defend myself. But before I could get a round off, Doug pulled the trigger and shot me right in the belly. Doug must have pumped his gun 20 times or more because I fell to my knees, looked down, and there was a hole and some blood where the pellet went through my shirt and inside of me. We were both pretty surprised and wonderfully amazed at the same time. We had just become one of those stories you hear about. Doug prayed for me and told me not to walk towards the light. I told Doug he could have my bicycle if I didn't make it. We put gum and leaves over the hole to stop the bleeding and made our way back to Doug's bedroom to get some tweezers and get the pellet out. We splashed some scope mouthwash on the hole to clean it, then dug in with the tweezers to get the pellet. He awarded me the Purple Heart, I gave him a sniper medal, and we vowed to go back and shoot at each other as often as we could. I liked how Doug did life. He was full of adventure and always had some wonderful mischief in mind. Sitting on the edge of Doug's bed laughing about the day, Doug began telling me the story about another man of adventure named Jesus, who lived a long time ago. Like Doug, Jesus wasn't a religious guy. To me, Jesus sounded like an ordinary guy who was utterly amazing. He helped people. He figured out what they really needed and tried to point them towards that. He healed people who were hurting. He spent time with the kinds of people most of us spend our lives avoiding. It didn't seem to matter to Jesus who these people were because he was all about engagement. That's one of the things I saw in Doug. I liked that Doug could be friends with Jesus and still shoot pellet guns. I didn't think that was allowed, but apparently it was. I don't have one of those harrowing stories you sometimes hear when people describe their initial encounter with Jesus. I wasn't on drugs, I hadn't committed any felonies, and I hadn't been in jail. I hadn't even had much exposure to religion, and what I did know, I didn't particularly understand. There was something about communion and something about Sunday school, and whatever the question was, Jesus was supposed to be the answer. There was also something about studying the Bible with a bunch of guys on Wednesdays, which sounded kind of weird because I thought you were supposed to read it and do what it said, not just study it. Maybe there was a workbook that went with it. All I knew of faith were fragments and shards of various traditions, but I had never heard the whole story about who Jesus was and what he wanted the world to know about him. Despite my lack of prior knowledge, when my sniper friend Doug told me the whole story, it made a lot of sense. I think it was more about what I saw in Doug than what he had to say to me. In fact, until we were in his room in post-op, he hadn't talked about Jesus much at all. Still, I knew Doug had something I wanted. I never wanted religion. I didn't understand it and didn't particularly want to either. To be honest, I thought being religious was for wimpy guys who didn't get into mischief. Though Doug wasn't a good shot, or maybe he was a great one, depending on how you look at it. He wasn't a wimp, and he seemed to know a person, a real living God, who liked him and even loved him, even though Doug was as screwed up as I was. Because of Doug, I believed in this God, and I wanted to know him too. I believed that Jesus wasn't just so much blue smoke to make religion seem like the real thing. He was the real thing, and he had a lot of firepower. I'm in my 50s now, and I don't run around the woods playing with BB guns. That's way too tame. I have a playful spirit, but I'm also a lawyer, and I have ties and suit jackets in the same closet that now holds my rusty BB gun. At times I'm struck by how strange it is that the same person who's gone through as many life changes over the years as I have can believe in this God who is still the same because he never changes. And it's even stranger because I have a legal mind and I spend my time proving things for a living. It's very hard to prove God, yet I still go on believing. I have an overwhelming sense of gratitude as I get older because I can see, both through the good times and the bad times, that God has been with me. Because I'm a lawyer and a follower of Jesus, I'm occasionally asked by people about my religion. I'm not always sure what they hope to learn from me, and the first thing I tell them is that they probably shouldn't be talking to me. I don't validate my faith with a church attendance scorecard. I think of church as a vibrant community of people consisting of two or more of varied backgrounds gathering around Jesus. Sometimes they're at a place that might have a steeple or auditorium seating, but it's just as likely the church happens elsewhere, like coffee shops or on the edge of a glacier or in the bush in Uganda. All these places work fine, I suppose. When it's a matter of the heart, the place doesn't matter. For me, it's Jesus plus nothing, not even a building. When my friends ask about my faith, I tell them that a long time ago, my friend Doug told me about Jesus and said I could know him. I didn't start believing in Jesus just because Doug had shot me, but I've never stopped believing in him even though I've caught some sniper fire from some religious people since then. There's a passage in the Bible that says people who haven't met Jesus are going to think that people who have met him are crazy. I get that look sometimes, and it's usually from people who don't have a lot of creativity or haven't experienced whimsy or haven't played with BB guns or been shot once or twice. The people who slowly become typical have the greatest problem wrapping their minds around a dynamic friendship with an invisible, alive God. There's nothing wrong with being typical, I guess, but there's nothing fundamentally right about it either. I've never read in Genesis that God created typical and called it good. Instead, I think men who were bored made up typical and called it, well, if not good, at least acceptable. People who follow Jesus, though, are no longer typical. God is constantly inviting them into a life that moves away from typical. Even if they have normal jobs, live in normal houses, and drive normal cars, they're just not the same anymore. The ones Jesus first picked to follow him started out typical, to be sure. They were unschooled and ordinary. Fishermen, business people, blind people, loose women, rip-offs, and vagrants. They were people who were lousy shots, like me and Doug. Folks who had been injured in life and patched together with gum and leaves and grace. But like my BB gun, what Christ followers lack in velocity, they make up for in intensity. They are people who have experienced an intensely intimate friendship with Jesus and move forward with an intensity to parallel that experience. Jesus lets us be real with our life and our faith. Maybe my BB gun doesn't shoot as far as the next guy's. That used to matter to me, but it doesn't matter to me anymore. What Jesus said we could do is leave typical behind. We could leave all of the comparisons and all the trappings and all of the pretending of religion. Jesus told the people he was with that it's not enough to just look like you love God. He said we'd know the extent of our love for God by how well we loved people. Doug and I are still friends. I send him text messages once in a while to see how he's doing and find out if he shot anyone lately. I'm not that great at spelling, and thankfully my phone autocorrects the words I type for me. What I've noticed, though, is that almost every time I type in the word love, it gets changed to the word live. It's kind of a reminder to me of one of the things I learned from Doug about following Jesus. I learned that fully loving and fully living are not only synonymous, but the kind of life that Jesus invited us to be a part of. And because of that, our lives don't need to just be puffs of blue smoke anymore. Chapter 3. The Rearview Mirror. I used to think I could shape the circumstances around me, but now I know Jesus uses circumstances to shape me. After high school, I went to Humboldt State University because I wanted to be a forest ranger. Actually, I took one of those aptitude tests in high school and slanted all the answers so that the school would report to my parents that if ever anyone was born to be a forest ranger, it was me. What I anticipated most about being a forest ranger is that you live in the woods. You get a green truck, you get a badge, and to top it off, you get a hat with a wide brim. After reading the test results I had rigged, my parents had to agree I was meant to be a forest ranger. My mom took me to the mountains where the forest rangers live. Where are all the girls, I thought. This was my first indication that my research had perhaps been flawed. Forest rangers didn't live in the woods the way I envisioned either. They lived in green concrete dormitories with cots lined up in rows under fluorescent lights. Their greatest adventure, it seemed, was giving tickets to people who parked in wrong places. They played cards a lot and ate TV dinners. I'd envisioned something a bit woodsier and manly, I suppose. Guns, moose heads, snowshoes leaning up against a large stone fireplace, a pile of beef jerky on the table, something along those lines. What I learned is that most forestry majors at the university go to work for forest products companies like Georgia-Pacific or Weyerhaeuser and manage the cutting down of forests to make paper or wrappers and those sort of things. I was discouraged, but it was too late to change schools, so I went to Humboldt as a forestry major. Shortly into my first year at Humboldt, disenchanted at the lack of girls and the business of harvesting forests in general, I decided it was time to make a change. I moved to San Diego, enrolled in the university there, and took up surfing. There would certainly be a future for me in that. What made even more sense to me is that my high school sweetheart, Kathy, also was going to UCLA and I could be near her. What I didn't count on, however, was getting my first Dear Bob letter a short time later. In her brief letter, Kathy said that after arriving at UCLA, she had become romantically involved with her big brother. She's involved with her big brother? I gasped as the limp paper dangled in my hands. Isn't that against the law or something? Besides, I didn't even know Kathy had a big brother. What's his name, anyway? What I learned later is that Kathy had joined a sorority and that her big brother was Greek speak for a guy from a fraternity the sorority sisters pair up with. I was so hurt. I almost wished for the other version I initially understood to salvage my ego. I vowed never to love again. I also vowed never to join a fraternity or be part of the Greek system. I started a list of other Greek things I would boycott. On my short list were gyros, olives, and the tentative removal of my Achilles tendon. When I got Kathy's letter, it seemed that my whole brief life had evaporated. So I did what all lovesick young men do. I got in my Volkswagen Bug and drove 20 hours from Humboldt State in the northern end of California to UCLA at the southern end. My assassin friend Doug came with me, and after two flat tires, lots of coffee, and several Jolt Colas, we made it to Los Angeles. I dropped Doug off somewhere and headed over to Kathy's sorority house, which was just off Sunset Boulevard near UCLA. It was an immense house with stone creatures lining the front walk to intimidate any and all dumped boyfriends who approached. I timidly took step after step, grabbed the door knocker, and tapped on the austere double door, which rang with an air of impenetrability. I could hear the hollow reverberations inside, and from all appearances, the house was utterly empty. But then, just as I was about to turn on my heels and retreat, I heard the faint sound of footsteps approaching the door. The door handle moved as I gulped and stood up tall. The door swung open, and there, just like in a perfect movie moment, was Kathy. "Bob Goff?" she gasped in a mortified half-shout, half-moan. Apparently, she was the only girl in the sorority house at the time, and I'd obviously caught her by surprise. Actually, her body language gave off kind of a combination plate of surprise, alarm, and I think I saw her throw up a little bit in the back of her mouth. "Come in," she stuttered, almost trying to retrieve the words as she spoke them. I knew it was over, but I went in anyway. You don't waste a 20-hour road trip like that. As I walked in, I was immediately taken by the grandeur of the huge sorority house. There was a marble entryway with bronze accents, marble walls with bronze fixtures, marble and bronze statues spread like centuries in every direction. I guess that the founder of the sorority must have invented marble or bronze or something. Just off the entryway, which we quickly transited, was another huge room anchored by a fireplace and a crackling fire and punctuated by a life-size bust of someone set on a table behind the couch. I figured it must have been a president or a prime minister, but wasn't sure. Kathy quickly and nervously ran me through the house for a quick tour. She was always polite. I fleetingly wondered how odd it must have been for her to have me there. As Kathy whisked me toward the front door again, I passed the fireplace room, and what struck me strange is that the bust in front of the fireplace was gone. It was just gone. Really, I thought? What happened to the bronze bust? Los Angeles was indeed an even more unusual place than I'd originally thought. I was still scratching my head and puzzling over what was missing when Kathy hurried me out the door. We walked to campus, where Kathy pointed to one building after another and told me about all the amazing experiences she was having and all the amazing people who went to UCLA. But we never really got around to the "why did you dump me" conversation. This was not by accident, of course, because what I gathered later had occurred was this. Kathy and her big brother were the only ones at the sorority that day and were snuggling on the couch in front of the fireplace when I knocked on the door. When Kathy said my name, the guy immediately froze and struck up a chiseled pose as I walked by. Later, as Kathy was touring me around the house, he must have slipped out the front door. The chap kept looping around and passing by the two of us as we walked around campus. I guess the guy who ends up with a girl sometimes is just as insecure as the guy who gets dumped by her. Later that afternoon, Kathy walked me out to my Volkswagen, and I opened the door. I didn't really know what to say. I finally got out, "Did you really mean what you said in your letter about us?" It wasn't one of the deep, thoughtful, probing questions I had practiced all the way down to Los Angeles, but it was all I could come up with at the time. "Yep," she confirmed as she patted me on the hand, stepped back, and muttered something about how she had to run to class. I drove away dejected as I left UCLA and Kathy in the rearview mirror. Kathy married Bronze Boy, and I never really found out why I got upstaged. The fact that he was more handsome than me, had more potential than me, was smarter than me, and wasn't angling for a career that involved living in the woods, sleeping on a cot, eating TV dinners, or surfing may have been more than a feather in the balance. Nevertheless, it's still hard to come in second. I've learned that God sometimes allows us to find ourselves in a place where we want something so bad we can't even see past it. Sometimes we can't even see God because of it. And when we want something that bad, it's easy to mistake what we truly need for the thing that we really want. When this sort of thing happens, and it seems to happen to everyone, I found it's because what God has for us is obscured from view, just around another bend in the road. In the Bible, the people following God had the same problem I did. They swapped the real thing for an image of the real thing. We target the wrong thing, and our misdirected life's goal ends up looking like a girl or a wide-brimmed hat or a golden calf. All along, what God really wants for us is something much different, something much more tailored to us. It's in my nature, maybe in all of our natures, to try to engineer things. So I skew the answers to get what I thought I wanted. But when I do that, I also get what I don't want, too, like a cot in a room full of guys. The first time I wanted someone to care for me as much as I cared for her, she picked someone else, and I tried to talk her out of it. If I had been successful, I wouldn't have experienced love in the unique way that I have. I wouldn't have found who and what God tailor-made for me. I'm kind of glad I didn't end up being a forest ranger or a surfer. I'm even glad things turned out the way they did after I drove away from UCLA. While painful at the time, I can see now, many years later, when I look in the rearview mirror of my life, evidence of God's tremendous love and unfolding adventure for me. I've received many letters since then in my life that started out, "Dear Bob." Some were letters so thick that they had to be folded several times to fit in the envelope. They left me feeling as folded when I read their words with shattering disappointment. Still, whatever follows our "Dear Bobs" is often another reminder that God's grace comes in all shapes, sizes, and circumstances as God continues to unfold something magnificent in me. And when each of us looks back at all of the turns and folds God has allowed in our lives, I don't think it looks like a series of folded-over mistakes and do-overs that have shaped our lives. Instead, I think we'll conclude in the end that maybe we're all a little bit more like human origami, and the more creases we have, the better. Chapter 4. Ryan in Love. I used to think being loved was the greatest thing to think about, but now I know love is never satisfied just thinking about it. We have a house down by the water, and there's a little grass path where couples hold hands and walk along the bayfront. My wife and I sit on the back porch and hold hands a lot, too, as we watch the couples meander by. We're close enough to the water that they wave to us and we wave back, a nostalgic snippet from another time where people wave to each other during slow walks. This is where I met Ryan. One day, Ryan came walking down the path all alone. Ryan waved us, and we waved back like we do to everyone. But instead of moving on, Ryan just stood there on the path, waving and not moving. Because he kept waving, we kept waving. It was a little awkward, honestly. I wondered if perhaps this young man wanted to talk. So to break the tension, I made the short walk from the porch to the path to say hello. "Hi there, how's it going?" I said, reaching out to shake his hand and give him a break from all the waving. "Hi, I'm Ryan, and I'm in love," he said confidently. Ryan had that glazed-over look that smitten guys get. "Well, Ryan, that's just great. Congratulations." No, that's not why I came," Ryan stammered. "What I wanted to say is that I walk by your house all the time, and I have this girlfriend, you see," and he paused. "I want to know if it would be okay," he paused again, "if I asked my girlfriend to marry me in your backyard." He talked like he'd been holding his breath for quite some time. I was taken aback by this love-glazed kid who would approach a complete stranger and ask to use his house to stage a great caper. But that's the way it is when you're in love, isn't it? All he knew was that he wanted the girl, and he was going to do whatever it took to get her. "Ryan, that sounds like a fantastic idea," I said, laughing. "Really?" Ryan answered. I guess he had expected an instant no or a gentler, "I'll think about it." "Sure, go get your girl. Let's get you two engaged." With that, Ryan went half-skipping, half-floating down the grassy path. I think his feet hit the path every 20 feet or so. He was being strategic. He was being audacious. He knew what he was going to do. He was going to go get that girl. A few days later, we were sitting on the back porch again. Couples were walking down the path holding hands. We would wave to them, and they would wave to us. Then came an animated figure bouncing and waving happily with both arms. It didn't take long for me to figure out it was Ryan, and I walked down the path to greet him. "Hi," Ryan yelped with a wonderfully goofy, glazed-over, I'm-in-love grin. "Hi, Ryan, what can I do for you?" "Well, you know how I'm going to propose in your backyard?" "Yes, I remember that." "I was wondering if you think it would be possible for us." He did another Ryan pause, so I knew whatever followed would be a whopper. "To have dinner on your back porch before I pop the question." I bit my tongue to keep from laughing out loud. I'd never even met Ryan before last week, and now he was asking if he could have his marriage proposal and dinner on my back porch. This kid has it bad. After a short pause, I shot back to young Ryan. "What the heck? Of course you can have dinner on my back porch, Ryan. That's a great idea. What can I make you?" I don't think he heard the question because off went Ryan down the path. He seemed to be levitating. He may have touched down on the grass once or twice over the next 100 yards. Ryan was another step closer to his prize. He was all in. He was all about doing and not just dreaming. He was going to get that girl. By now, I found myself looking forward to my afternoon encounters with young Ryan. It reminded me how fun it was to be young and in love. I even started coming home early from work to sit on the back porch waiting for him, checking my watch every 5 minutes or so, wondering when he would come bouncing down the path with another outlandish request for a total stranger. And sure enough, Ryan came bounding down the path again, so I went down to greet him. "Hi, Bob. Hey, I was thinking..." And then there was another pregnant pause. "Would it be possible for me to have some friends of mine serve us when we're having dinner on your porch?" "You bet," I shot back, laughing. I was already this far with Ryan. What could it hurt to have a few of his friends over? "What a great idea. How many would you like to have serve you two dinner?" Ryan looked up with a Cheshire Cat grin and sheepishly said, 20? Did he just say he wanted 20 people inside my house to be his servers? I was wonderfully stunned by the consistently audacious, almost vertical trajectory of Ryan's plans. He wanted 20 people to serve a dinner for two? Now that's service. But when love does it big. "What a great idea, Ryan. 20 it is," I said without hesitation. Ryan bounced away down the bayfront. I could tell that his head was ready to explode with anticipation. He had the vision, he had the plan, he had the place, and he had the staff. He was trigger-locked on the goal, and he was going to get that girl. A few days later, I was at my post. Almost on cue, Ryan came galloping down the path. "Ryan, how are the plans coming?" "Well," he said, "I was actually wondering if it would be okay if after dinner and after my friends leave, You could put some speakers on the porch and maybe we could dance for a bit. Of course you want to dance on a stranger's porch. Speakers it is, I told him. Anything else? I was trying to get all the possibilities out of him now. Well, I think that about covers it. I'll ask her to marry me after we dance for a bit. Great idea, I said to Ryan. Go get that girl. Ryan skipped off. A day or two passed with no Ryan sightings. I almost felt a low-grade depression sinking in on me. Was the planning over? Were there no more whimsical and outrageous ideas from Ryan as he planned his caper? Was the mischief done? I sat on my porch, reflecting on how contagious Ryan's brand of love was. And then, almost on cue, Ryan came running down the pathway again. At this point, Ryan was a regular, and he bounded across the lawn and up the porch without hesitation. He was pretty winded, actually, leaning over with his hands on his knees, trying to catch his breath. I wondered if I should give him a paper bag to breathe into. After a few long moments, Ryan straightened up. There was a pause while our stares met. I had learned that a pause by Ryan meant that there was another whopper of an idea brewing in his head. Hey, Ryan, what's up? It's great to see you. How are the plans coming? Do you, he exhaled. Have, he inhaled. A boat? A boat? I was belly laughing as I asked him to repeat what I thought he had just said. Yeah, do you have a boat? Ryan asked more confidently this time as he straightened up a bit. Well, actually, Ryan, I do, I said with half enthusiasm and half awe at Ryan's love-induced, audacious bender. He had that glazed-over look again as he looked at me squarely in the eyes. Well, can I borrow it? Ryan was out of control. He had no idea what an outrageous thing he was asking. But you see, to Ryan, I wasn't a total stranger. No one was. To him, the whole world was full of co-conspirators when it came to winning over his love. He was completely unaware of and unimpeded by what was proper, what was acceptable, and what was conventional. Nothing was going to get in the way of what he decided he was going to do. Okay, Ryan, the boat's yours, I said. I'll take you and your girlfriend out on my boat after dinner at my house, after your 20 friends finish serving you, and after you dance together on my porch. You can pop the question to your girl up on the front deck of the boat. Ryan floated away once again, clueless of the beautiful ridiculousness that this girl was bringing out in him. Ryan was a study in focus, tenacity, and abandon. He was all gas and no brake. What Ryan didn't realize is that I decided to one-up him. Why should he have all the fun? That night, I called the Coast Guard, and I told them about Ryan's elaborate plan and his glazed-over enthusiasm for his girl, which had swept him into a state of unparalleled whimsy. Ryan's enthusiasm was contagious, and pretty soon the guy on the other end of the phone had caught the bug, too. The Coast Guard officer and I hatched a plan of our own. When the big night came, everything was in place. The night was balmy, the air was clear, and I think the stars even came out a few minutes early to see Ryan's elaborate scheme unfold. Ryan and his girl came walking down the path. When they got to the white Nantucket house on the bay, he led her up the stairs and across the lawn toward a candlelit table on the porch. Ryan, what are we doing? Is this okay? Whose house is this? She whispered as she held his arm a little tighter. Ryan pulled out her chair and said this was for her, and he sat her down. The service at dinner by the 20 servers was impeccable, and the after-dinner dance was endearing as the two stood with arms around each other, slowly moving together on the porch. As they danced, they twirled and talked quietly. By now, evening had fully set in, and the lights of the city, mixed with the stars, were starting to dominate the skyline. It was as if early-appearing stars had gone home and invited all their friends, telling them, "You have got to see this." The evening was coming to its natural end, and Ryan took his girl by the hand, and they headed back to the path. I've always wondered what was going through her head during all of this. I hope it felt like a dream. As they got closer to the dock behind the house, Ryan gripped her hand, turned, and took her towards a boat that was tied at the end. "Ryan, what are we doing?" she half demanded. "Come on," is all he had to say as they came onto my boat. I was at the helm, and they made their way up to the bow. With the stars out in full view, we slowly motored out into the bay. After a short time, we approached the spot where Ryan and I agreed I would stop the boat so he could pop the question. In a total coup de grace, Ryan had 50 more of his friends on the shore to spell out, "Will you marry me?" with candles, just in case he got tongue-tied or overwhelmed in the intensity and whimsy of the moment. With her flickering sign at his backdrop, Ryan got on one knee. Will, he exhaled. You, he inhaled. Mary, he paused. Me. There was a gasp, followed by an immediate and enthusiastic yes. In this, the most special moment of their lives, neither Ryan nor his bride-to-be noticed that the Coast Guard had pulled in behind us with their firefighting boat, just as the officer and I had planned. I gave the thumbs up, the sign that she had said yes, and he shot off every water cannon he had on the entire rig. It was a scene that belonged in New York Harbor on the 4th of July with a Statue of Liberty in the background. But it wasn't happening there. It was happening for Ryan because that's the way love rolls. It multiplies. Ryan and his bride-to-be let the mist from the water cannons settle over them like a thousand small kisses. Ryan's love was audacious. It was whimsical. It was strategic. Most of all, it was contagious. Watching Ryan lose himself in love reminded me that being engaged isn't just an event that happens when a guy gets on one knee and puts a ring on his true love's finger. Being engaged is a way of doing life, a way of living and loving. It's about going to extremes and expressing the bright hope that life offers us, a hope that makes us brave and expels darkness with light. That's what I want my life to be all about, full of abandon, whimsy, and in love. I want to be engaged in life and with life. I enjoy the parts of the Bible where Jesus talks about how much he loves his bride. It makes me wonder if the trees and mountains and rivers are things he planned in advance, knowing they would wow us. I wonder if God returned over and over to this world he placed us in, thinking what he'd created was good, but it could have been even better, even grander. I wonder if he thought each foggy morning, each soft rain, each field of wildflowers would be a quiet and audacious way to demonstrate his tremendous love for us. I don't know if God was a little bit like Ryan when he created everything or if Ryan was a little bit like God. But what I do know is that Ryan's audacious love is some of the best evidence I've found of the kind of love Jesus talked about, a love that never grows tired or is completely finished finding ways to fully express itself. Chapter 5. The Reach. I used to be afraid of failing at something that really mattered to me. But now, I'm more afraid of succeeding at things that don't matter. My first real job was at Lear's Greenhouse Restaurant. It was a fantastic glass building designed to look like an arboretum. It was the crystal cathedral of fine dining. Each table was set inside its own wonderfully ornate white gazebo, and there were dozens of them. The crystal was perfect. The china was delicate. The waiters were coiffed and formal in their black tuxedos, cummerbunds, and bow ties. When I applied to work at Lear's, I imagined how great I would look in a tux, how I would memorize the menu and make every prom date or business dinner flawless. I also imagined myself counting my pile of money from generous tips. In order to become a waiter at Lear's Greenhouse, I had to start as a busboy and work my way up. I did pretty well, I guess, but then again, how can you screw up collecting dirty dishes? It was hard work, but the thought of being a waiter someday made it all worth it. As a busboy, I learned that tables enveloped in these white gazebos, while creating a stunning atmosphere, make for some tight and hard-to-maneuver situations. By the time I got to the tables to pick up the dishes, everyone would be gone, and I wondered how the waiters navigated that reach. On my one-year anniversary, the maitre d' pulled me aside and said I could buy my tuxedo and become a waiter. I was at the tuxedo shop the next morning as soon as it opened up. When opening night came for me and I had my first shift as a waiter, I was so excited I could barely eat. I sprinted out from my small apartment and grabbed some quick Mexican food around the corner because they wouldn't let us eat food at the restaurant. I rushed back and slipped on my tuxedo for the first time since trying it on at the store. The tuxedo was expensive, but I knew I'd earn enough in tips over the next month or two to pay for it. I'd put down half the money when I bought it, and had agreed to pay off the rest in payments from my new waiter job. I intentionally lingered around the apartment complex where I lived just long enough for everyone living near me to see that I indeed had a tuxedo with a ruffled shirt. I left it to their imaginations to figure out just how special I was. I hopped into my thrashed VW Bug, drove to the restaurant, and parked around the corner to make sure no one saw me pull up in the VW. I wanted to have that 007 my other cars an Aston Martin look. The night was cloudless. You could see the stars through the glass ceiling. Cinderella wouldn't have been out of place pulling up in her carriage. There were twinkle lights on all of the gazebos. It was like Christmas in July. The whole restaurant had a new feel to me, like I'd been an understudy in a play and now was walking out on the big stage as the lead. The maitre d' escorted my first guest to one of the elegant gazebos in my zone. It looked like a wealthy doctor and his business guest. They each were starched and tidy, and each guy actually looked like he could have been the Surgeon General. The women looked like they had stepped off the cover of Vogue. The women sat down as the gentlemen slid in their chairs. As soon as the men were settled, I put napkins in everyone's lap and gave them the speech I'd rehearsed a dozen times in my bathroom mirror while my toothpaste and deodorant listened. I told them about the many incredible choices they had that evening for what would certainly be the best food, best service, and most remarkable dining experience of their lives. In a word, I promised that the evening would be flawless. I placed their orders and after a short time came back to the gazebo with the steaming plates. All seemed to be going well until the unthinkable happened. As I was making the big reach across the wide table, I felt this massive grumbling somewhere south of my stomach, down as deep as one could imagine.